What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to the first episode of Intelligence Squared in 2021. We're starting this year with a foreign policy episode, and it features a guest who may be familiar to some of you. It's Madawi al-Rashid, the Saudi dissident professor and writer who took part in our big debate last year on whether the West should cut ties with Saudi Arabia. Well, this time she came back to our online subscription service Intelligence Squared Plus and spoke to the BBC's Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen about her new book, The Sun King: Reform and Repression in Saudi Arabia. It's a really fascinating conversation that looks at how the country has changed and stayed the same since the reign of Mohammed bin Salman. And if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for the book in the podcast description. But now, let's go to the episode.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I've really been looking forward to this session because there's a lot to talk about. And we have the best person possible to talk about Saudi Arabia, Madawi al-Rashid. She is one of the foremost authorities on the country, visiting professor, professor of social anthropology at the LSE, Middle East Centre. She's written a number of excellent books about Saudi Arabia, one about the legacy of King Salman, of course, the current king. But now we have this one. Here it is. I'll wave it again, in case you didn't catch it when Connor waved it. The Sun King, Reform and Repression in Saudi Arabia, published by Hearst. As you can see from my notes in it, my post-it notes, Sim, I have read this very thoroughly, learnt a lot, enjoyed it. And, you know, for a foreign journalist like myself, Saudi Arabia, to be honest with you, has always been a bit of a hard nut to crack. First of all, it's quite hard to work there. Second of all, a lot of what passes for seemingly well-informed comment I've learnt over the years is quite often based on a bit of gossip and speculation. Now, one person who wrote with a great deal of authority, of course, was the late Jamal Khashoggi. Now, his appalling murder broke the spell that had been painstakingly woven, around Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, known for short, of course, as MBS. We're going to get on, I'm sure, to that notorious killing and the effect of it. But, Madawi, first of all, let's start with begin at the beginning. I mean, did people see him coming?
Thank you, Jeremy. And thank you, Intelligence Square, for this session. It wasn't inevitable that Mohammed bin Salman will rise to become the crown prince in such a short time, given his age and his lack of experience. But I think to understand why he came to power, we have to look at the Arab uprising in 2011, when quite a lot of dictators looked as if they're on their way out. And Saudi Arabia did have some kind of agitations, demonstrations, and the tide was inevitably going to reach Saudi Arabia because the demands of the demonstrators in Cairo, in Bahrain, in North Africa, in Yemen, were exactly the same in Saudi Arabia. But I think at that moment, the decision was taken to promote a young prince who would start social liberalization, open up Saudi Arabia, socially and economically, but keeping the political system intact as it is, as an absolute monarchy. So the choice was so obvious at the time that King Salman, when he became king in 2015, he started promoting one of his youngest sons. And he was seen as the new face of Saudi Arabia, a so-called modern, creative, entrepreneurial, and connected to the rest of the world through pop culture, entertainment, and also global capital and investment. So Mohammed bin Salman was promoted in order to mitigate against the tide of the Arab uprisings reaching Saudi Arabia.
Because one of the features, is it not, in the entire region, is that there's a very young population, a young population that suffers from a lot of unemployment. So the idea then was to connect with these people. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. But age is a construct, really, and we give it meaning. So I remember Western journalists talking about the aging Saudi monarchs, one dying followed and succeeded by another one equally old and on the way out. And so the prediction was actually rife that we will have a young Western-educated prince to become the future king of Saudi Arabia. But of course, that didn't happen in both situations. We do have a young prince, but he wasn't Western educated. And so people assume that there is value to being young or value to being Western educated. And therefore, without understanding the politics of the Saudi royal family, it is impossible to understand why Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, became so important and amassed so much powers in such a short time.
Well, the politics of that family are rather complicated, and they have been among the dominant forces since the 18th century, of course, in Saudi Arabia, and the dominant force since, well, for most of the last 100 years, I suppose. Just try and could you give us, for those of us, I would include myself in that, of course, who sometimes get a bit confused by the tangled family trees and the web of power, the varying and ebbing and flowing web of power in Saudi Arabia. Could you sum up for us what it is we really need to know about Saudi politics that produced this, remarkable man?
Yes, well, there are two phases to understand the royal family or royal politics. After the founder of the kingdom, King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, died in 1952, he wanted the succession to stay within his own sons, which means that if a king dies, it is his brother who becomes king. And this is unlike what Europe had experienced in its various monarchies. So the succession went from one son of the founder to his brother.
So horizontally.
A horizontal succession. And he had quite a lot of sons, I mean, estimated to be around 45. But we get to the 1990s, and after that, the royal family was running out of eligible young brothers of the king. And King Abdullah saw the death of two members of the royal family, very senior one, his crown prince and Minister of Defense, who was the deputy crown prince, King Sultan and Naif. And at that point, it became clear that when Salman becomes king, there won't be any brothers to succeed him or eligible brothers. They were old, the existing ones, or sidelined. So it was time to think about how the succession could move from the horizontal line to the vertical line. So King Salman sacked his Mohammed bin Naif, who was the Minister of Interior and the Crown Prince, and promoted his own son as Crown Prince. But he is yet to appoint a Deputy Crown Prince, which is the tradition in Saudi Arabia. And possibly because Mohammed bin Salman is young, the king doesn't feel there will be a power vacuum should something happens to him, and he is probably unlikely to die, as the previous crown princes did.
he has been making, right from the outset, a lot of waves. He really hit the ground running, showing, you know, tremendous energy. There was the war, not necessarily constructive energy. There was the war in Yemen. That's certainly when I first became aware of this man and his name, when all that started. And then everything that's happened ever since, of course. And there was that November 2017, the extraordinary affair in the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh, where he walled up a couple of hundred prominent officials and members of the royal family. And essentially, they had to buy their way out of that. What was the real story behind that? What was his motivation? Was he making a point? Was he trying to show who's boss? Or was it about knocking corruption and trying to recoup money that some of the notoriously corrupt people in that country had stolen?
Well, it's absolutely not about corruption. The problem that Mohammed bin Salman, because of his young age and because of excluding not only his own elder brother, but other cousins who are more eligible and who had experience in government, like Mohammed bin Nayef, he wanted to prove himself and prove that he is tough. So he became Minister of Defense, Crown Prince, head of the Economic Council. And given the old age of his father, he was actually running the show. But this doesn't mean that he had the consensus of the Saudi royal family behind him. Before King Salman, the state was run like multiple fiefdoms, and each senior prince has his own ministry. So Prince Nayef, the crown prince, had the Ministry of Interior. Prince Sultan had the Ministry of Defense. And these are the main ministries. And they were almost like autonomous, but they came together and they did not challenge their brother. However, when Mohammed bin Salman was promoted in 2017, there was no consensus of the royal family. And a lot of members of that family thought that why Mohammed bin Salman when there are eligible princes who had more experience than him? So he is living in fear for his life, and he is worried about coups by members of the royal family. And as such, he managed to have almost all the sons of King Abdullah, Mit'ab and the others, in the Ritz-Carlton, confiscated their assets because he was worried about his future in a family that has not given him the full support and the consensus. So by promoting Mohammed bin Salman, the king, King Salman, has sidelined so many other princes. And corruption is a good cause. So we see, I mean, the reason why I argue in the book that this is not about corruption is because it was selective. It was selective in the sense that he cherry-picked some princes who might pose a threat and put them in the Ritz-Carlton. And the detention campaign against members of his own family continued. I mean, the last we heard about such detention was just like 7-8 months ago. And he will continue to do this in the future simply because he doesn't have that consensus that is so important to have the family behind you. And at the moment, they're all gone silent.
For the moment, do you think that might last? There is, it's not unknown for a Saudi king to be removed from power in the past. Do you think that he might one day just simply run out of his nine lives?
Well, historically, there has been cases of Saudi kings removed from power. The last one, I don't want to go into the 19th century and what happened then, but in the 1960s, King Saud was deposed, forced to leave the country, and he died abroad because Faisal, his crown prince, challenged him and kicked him out. And then in 1975, King Faisal himself was assassinated by his nephew in the palace. So it is not unlikely or unimaginable that we'll have this kind of situation, especially after King Salman dies. As King Salman at the moment gives him a legitimacy umbrella. He's like the untouchable now because he's the bright or so-called reformer, the Sun King. But after Salman dies, who knows?
There was an interesting story in The Guardian the other day about the former Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, who's been Well, no one's quite sure, but he appears to be under house arrest and has been for months on end. And for those who didn't see the story, it was essentially saying that there was a plot on social media accusing him, his lawyers said this, accusing him of plotting a coup, perhaps an alliance with Joe Biden. And don't forget, of course, that MBS has been a big friend of President Trump and also of the first son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So the quote was that interested me was it said that this social media activity was coming from inside Saudi Arabia. And quote, 40% of the tweets apparently show bot-like behavior. Now, MBS himself and his allies have quite adeptly used social media, haven't they, to push their points. Do you think that is a continuation of it, of that tendency?
Yes. When Mohammed bin Nayef was detained almost like 10 months ago, there were rumors on Twitter, also by bots and, you know, the infamous Twitter farm outside Riyadh, that he was on drugs. And then now they think that with the change in the American administration, maybe Mohammed bin Nayef will be revived and brought back, simply because Mohammed bin Nayef was the choice of many Western governments, including Britain, because of his work in the war on terror. And he cooperated and provided information, shared information on terrorism with Western intelligence services. So before he was deposed, only a week before he was deposed, he was given one of the most prestigious CIA medals for his contribution to the war on terror. But then suddenly Mohammed bin Salman became the face of Saudi Arabia, and Mohammed bin Nayef sunk into oblivion. So I'm not surprised that these tweets are circulating at the moment. But Mohammed bin Nayef or Mohammed bin Salman, I mean, they both have a record of repression. Mohammed bin Nayef was so hated by many people in Saudi Arabia because he actually started the police state and consolidated the surveillance and the technology that makes every Saudi citizen very, very vulnerable. And it is ironic that the work that Mohammed bin Nayef had done has benefited his successor, which is Mohammed bin Salman, and he wasn't able to actually benefit from all that spying and surveillance that he put in place.
We can't talk about Saudi Arabia without talking about religion, and we can't talk about religion in Saudi Arabia without talking about the Wahhabi version of Islam and the alliance between the Al Saud family and that particular tendency in religion that goes back until the middle of the 18th century. Is there a sense now, though, that Mohammed bin Salman is trying to do things a bit differently, that he is not trying to be as reliant on that alliance with the Wahhabi rubber stamp as his predecessors might have been?
Yes, I mean, as you mentioned, the Wahhabi tradition was instrumental in the foundation of the state. But Mohammed bin Salman wants to reverse that. He is yet to succeed simply because he still needs the Wahhabis. So to just give you examples, he told The Guardian to mention his interview when he said that he wants to start moderate Islam in Saudi Arabia. And moderate Islam involves sort of curbing the powers of the religious scholars, surveying greater surveillance of mosques, etc., and also suppressing the Islamists of all shades and colors. But when he needs the Wahhabis, he draws on their help. To just give you an example, in the war on Yemen, which started in 2015, King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman relied on the Wahhabi clerics to go to the battleground and encourage the soldiers to launch this war, because they called it jihad against the infidels. And the infidels in this particular case were the Yemeni Zaydis, who belong to a different branch of Islam that the Wahhabis hate and detest and think that they are not real Muslims. So that sort of sectarian discourse, which is integrated in Wahhabi doctrine, is promoted in the context of the war on Yemen. If, for example, Saudis want to take any civil resistance, if they want to demonstrate or express an opinion or go on strike, then the king and his son will use the Wahhabi fatwas, which are religious decrees, to prohibit demonstrations, because they can argue that it is against Islam and you are committing blasphemy against God if you demonstrate. And therefore, at the moment, the Wahhabi tradition is dormant, but it can be reactivated on demand. When King Salman or his son Mohammed bin Salman want to use it, it's out there. They can quickly sort of ignite its zeal and excesses.
And that's an alliance which has worked for them for more than 250 years.
Absolutely. But at the moment, Mohammed bin Salman probably thinks that they've exhausted the Islamic legitimacy of the regime. Because remember, the Saudi kings are the custodians of the two holy mosques, and therefore they claim that they are leaders of the Sunni Muslim world or of Muslims in general. But that had been exhausted and reached a dead end with the 9/11 event. And since then, we see the promotion of nationalism as an alternative to religious nationalism. So Mohammed bin Salman adopted the slogans, ironically, that Trump had promoted, Saudi Arabia is great, or make Saudi Arabia great, or Saudi Arabia is for Saudis. And all these kind of slogans are trying to create a new national consciousness to promote people, to push them, to mobilize them. But this nationalism is centered on loyalty to Mohammed bin Salman. And it's not really a loyalty to the nation. It's loyalty to the future king. And also it has its own contradictions and problems, like all nationalisms in the world.
You just mentioned, of course, President Trump in his, final hours, more or less, or days, so most people think anyway, in the White House. What is your analysis of the changes that have happened in the Gulf in the last few months with the normalization agreements with between the Emiratis and Israel, Bahrain as well, Sudanese having their arms somewhat twisted to join the party? Where exactly is Saudi Arabia on that? There was that meeting quite recently between Netanyahu and MBS. And, one of the analysis that one reads quite a bit is simply that while King Salman is still there, he can't give up the Saudi-authored Arab peace plan, which is, of course, that normalization with Israel's fine as long as it follows independence for the Palestinians. But once the old man's gone, well, who knows?
Yes. Well, at the moment, I think it's the king's dilemma. King Salman is damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. So he can't. He has to go through a cost-benefit analysis and see what he's getting out of this. And in a way, Trump was his friend, and Jared Kushner was a friend of Mohammed bin Salman, and they all worked together. But Saudi-Israeli relations date back to the 1960s. And the Saudis the Saudi leadership just can't go public with these relations. And they can't go along the path of the United Arab Emirates or Bahrain or even Sudan, simply because they worry about the opinion of the people. They would lose actually the last sort of brick in their sort of legitimacy narrative. They can't rule without this sort of claim that they work on behalf of Muslims, given that they are the custodians of Mecca and Medina. But King Salman decided to wait and see. And it's interesting that only this week there was news that Netanyahu came to Saudi Arabia for a very quick meeting with Mohammed bin Salman. And obviously they denied it, although the news came in the Israeli press. But immediately, within like a week, Prince Turki Al Faisal, who was ambassador in London and also the ex-director of the intelligence services, went to a conference in Bahrain, IISS, and he sort of had this diatribe about Israel. He was actually talking to his domestic audience, not to the people in the conference. He wanted to reassure them on behalf of the king and his son that Saudi Arabia is committed to the rights of Palestinians. But the economic intelligence and military cooperation between the two countries, Saudi Arabia and Israel, had developed. And there's a whole sort of literature on these clandestine relations.
We are nearly running out of time on our 30 minutes before we open this up more to questions, but a couple more things. So first off, how important in all this is the shared antipathy that the Israelis and the Saudis have to Iran?
This is the common cause, and the worrying thing is that they are both not restrained and they may sort of launch a certain attack that would bring the whole region into war. I think Mohammed bin Salman has overestimated his military capabilities. In a country like Yemen, the war is 5 years old in Yemen, and until now, recently, the Houthi missiles reach Saudi territory, and they are intercepted. Sometimes they hit a wrong target, and we have seen how the oil fields are also attacked regularly throughout these 5 years. One attack was so serious that it stopped the oil production and export. So Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman might be foolish to launch an attack that would bring the whole region into more war and devastation.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Let's talk a little bit about the loving that happened in the early years of Mohammed bin Salman's tenure as Crown Prince. There was that celebrated trip to the United States, the gushing pieces about this great bear of a man who might be king of Saudi Arabia into the next century, etc., etc., etc. Then, of course, things changed greatly after the murder of Khashoggi in the consulate in Istanbul. The celebrated American columnist Tom Friedman, I think, gave him a very, very favorable reception when he burst onto the scene, when MBS did. What do you make of that whole, the whole mechanism, the love-in, then followed by the realization when the curtain was drawn back on that terrible killing? And what does that say to you as well about Western observers and would-be interpreters of what's going on?
Yes, I think Thomas Friedman and many others in respectable US and UK media fell under the spell of Mohammed bin Salman. It was almost like wishful thinking that he would be this imposing young man, very energetic, who works until like 3 a.m. in the morning and plays video games. I mean, there was this sensational sort of reporting on Saudi Arabia. And I think it goes back earlier than journalism. It goes back to how many travelers and Western writers glorified Ibn Saud, the founder of the kingdom, although he was in alliance with the most radical religious groups that had emerged in the Arab world for centuries. But I do remember reading British travelers glorifying this man who came from the desert. There is that kind of orientalism.
Tall. It was the size, too, they liked, didn't they? Just like with MBS.
Absolutely.
He was a tall man.
Yes.
Imposing, not like those other little men, I suppose they meant.
Yes. So, unfortunately, Western media fell under the spell and thought that, you know, reform in Saudi Arabia is all about allowing women to drive, going to theater, watching football matches, inviting pop stars to the country, having boxing matches where women could actually attend. But none of those Western journalists asked the big question, the taboo question. Is there any sign of political reform? Is there a sign of having a representative government in Saudi Arabia? There were no signs of any kind of elections that might take place and give the people a voice. And only when Jamal Khashoggi was murdered on the 2nd of October 2018, that, you know, Thomas Friedman and the others thought that, oh, we got it wrong. It is time now to reconsider our assessment. This is a brutal murder of one of us. And Jamal Khashoggi was a journalist.
You mentioned changes to those restrictions on women. You know, the most celebrated, of course, the prohibition on driving. And I have there not been a few reforms to the guardianship system? But do you think that despite the fact that, of course, at the same time as he was allowing some more freedoms, he was putting female protesters, feminists in jail, do you think that Mohammed bin Salman has made life better in any sense for women in Saudi Arabia?
Some women are enjoying the right to drive. And this professional women who have to go to their jobs, teachers, nurses, doctors, etc. But this comes at a very, very high price. The restriction on freedom of expression, a restriction on women's ability to represent themselves are still in place. Until the present day, a Saudi woman cannot marry without the authorization or the permission of her guardian. So in marriage, women are not regarded as adults. They need to be represented, and they have to seek permission to get married. So yes, there are certain changes that had affected women in a positive way, but I think you can't talk about this kind of social liberalization without real rights, without real political right, without the idea of equal citizenship. And we are still far behind other countries in the region, let alone in the world. So yes, there is reform, but there is heavy-handed repression at the same time. Lujain al-Hudhloul, who is a feminist, young 30-year-old activist who campaigned for the right to drive and got arrested and put in prison in 2014. But she's still in prison now. And when Mohammed bin Salman came to power, she was summoned to prison. And she is now transferred to a court that deals with terrorism. And she is just an educated woman who campaigned. But it is not surprising that Mohammed bin Salman picked those women and put them in prison, because the feminist movement in Saudi Arabia had surpassed all schisms within society, whether they are regional, ideological, or even sectarian. So women's rights united so many regions, so many tribal groups. And this is why Mohammed bin Salman feared this rising vocal feminist movement. He prefers regions and groups to work within their own sect, within their own community. But a national opposition is what he actually fears.
Right, we have got a variety of questions coming in, as a matter of fact. So let's start dealing with a couple of those. Can you, this is from Anil Nanda, could you talk a little bit about MBS and his relationship with the United Arab Emirates? Who is the senior partner and how will the election of Joe Biden change this?
Yeah, and it is a very, very opaque relationship. But I think Mohammed bin Salman sees the...
This is the relationship with MBZ.
MBZ.
The ruler, the effective ruler of that country.
He is impressed by Dubai rather than the whole of the UAE. And he thought that he could turn Saudi Arabia into another UAE on a much bigger scale. His obviously, like all these kind of personalized political relations, it's very difficult to know what goes on. But it is obvious that the UAE early on wanted to play a role bigger than its size and even its wealth. And they saw the threat of Islamism in the region as undermining their success story, or the so-called success story of Dubai. And I think the decision was reached in Abu Dhabi, the capital, that in order to defeat Islamism, you really need to defeat it in its own country of origin, and that is Saudi Arabia. So MBZ is very keen on silencing all Islamist voices and becoming the policeman of the Gulf. And he has played sort of the guiding elder to Mohammed bin Salman so far. But we shall see, like all these kind of personalized relations, they are not based on some kind of solid institutional connections, and they come and go depending on personalities in power.
And Anil asks a follow-up. Did the UAE play a role in the appointment of MBS? There was apparently an article in the New York Times, which I clearly missed, suggesting there was a very strong link on that.
I mean, MBZ, through his ambassador in Washington, he built many connections. And he reminds me, Al-Utaybi, his ambassador, reminds me of Bandar bin Sultan, if you remember, Jeremy, in the 1990s and the Gulf War, and even up to 9/11. So he had these personalized relations with the Bush family, with the oil corporations. And I think after the departure of Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi ambassador, the UAE wanted to fill that vacuum and play the role and sort of be the sounding board of the American administration. And it coincided with Trump coming to power, who was very much interested in the transactional foreign policy that, you know, if you buy my arms or arms from my country, I'm happy to support you. And that went on, and Mohammed bin Salman benefited from that kind of context.
On the subject of arms, this question from me, actually. Do you think the, well, we hear a lot in this country, but the British and the Americans, clearly we sell vast amounts of weaponry, sophisticated weaponry to Saudi Arabia, and there is that intelligence relationship. And if you talk to members of the Conservative government here, for example, about our relations with Saudi Arabia, they'll say, well, yes, that we have put pressure on them on some issues because we're not that happy with some of the things they've been doing, like bombing civilians in Yemen with planes we sold them and maintain. But, you know, the relationship is very important economically. And as well as that, it's deeply rooted in our common history. We go back a long way. And as well as that, of course, there's that intelligence relationship. And believe you me, is what they say, the Saudis have helped us no end in dealing with extremism in our own country.
Well, I mean, this is the discourse of successive British governments and also in the United States. But I think in terms of cost benefit, there had been a lot of studies on British relations with Saudi Arabia and the arms sales. And it is actually blown out of proportion. Yes, there are jobs, but they're not the only jobs in the country. And Britain could have a foreign policy with a country like Saudi Arabia and upholding its values. And it doesn't mean that you sell them these planes that are used to bomb Yemen. You make that relationship conditional on these regimes and these dictatorships, respecting the basic rights of their citizens and their neighbors. But I think Britain likes the idea of having this yet another special relationship with Saudi Arabia, because it makes it project its power abroad. It makes it feel better that they have this really special, in inverted commas, with the Saudis. But, I mean, since the Second World War, this had been the dilemma of Britain, as the United States displaced Britain in terms of having the special relationship with Saudi Arabia. And the British logic is that if we don't sell Saudi Arabia arms, then the French would. And this is the kind of weapons market that is global, backed by powerful governments, and they're all searching for new opportunities and markets. Unfortunately, without a vigorous control over arms sales, we are going to continue pumping these regimes with weapons that are used either against their own people or against their neighbors. And you accelerate the chances of a war. As we have seen, the Yemen war was the first war that the Saudis used to test their military capabilities. They've never fought a war on their own. Their armies never fought a war on its own since the creation of the state. The Gulf War in 1990 was fought with 500,000 foreign soldiers, mainly Americans. And therefore, they wanted to test their military capabilities and started a war in Yemen that precipitated a humanitarian crisis that is still ongoing.
Let's talk a little bit about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Some men have been put on trial. What is likely to happen to them? MBS himself has denied that he had anything to do with it, though I think Trump said to Woodward that I saved that guy's ass on this particular subject. So if they took the orders of the Crown Prince, of course, I can't prove it, but all the circumstantial evidence seems to suggest that. The question is, will they take the fall for him? How does it work? Will their families have been given money to buy their silence? Will they be discreetly ushered out of jail in a year or two?
Yes, well, it's an opaque judiciary in Saudi Arabia. We don't know much about the process, the procedure, and they needed to have scapegoats to silence the loud voices around the world that condemned this crime. And the magnitude of the crime makes one believe with certainty that it could not have happened without some serious orders from above. I mean, the details of it at the time were horrific. And I documented in the book because I relied on the accounts of the woman who was with Khashoggi just standing outside his fiancée. And the Saudis would not allow an independent investigation. They refused from day one. And they regarded that as an infringement on their sovereignty. But sovereignty or no sovereignty, you commit a crime abroad on the premises of your consulate, I think the regime has gone too far in that particular...
That does appear... Yeah, that very much does appear to be the consensus, though, of course, Western countries certainly seem quite prepared to forgive and forget as soon as they can. An interesting question here from the audience. Do you think that Saudi Arabia could ever be a democracy? What would need to happen?
Well, it can be a democracy. There's nothing that stops a country from being a democracy. You need two conditions. You need the people to mobilize for democracy inside the country. And you need an international context that doesn't block the development of democracy, like what happened in Egypt, for example, in 2011, when people did demonstrate and did pay a high price. But then there were counter-revolutionary forces in the region, assisted by some Western governments, that derailed that drive towards democracy. And Saudi Arabia is not an exceptional case. There are people calling for democracy. We do have now a diaspora that consists of young men and women who had left the reforms and the paradise of Mohammed bin Salman, and they're stranded in around the globe, from Canada to the United States, Britain, Australia, Europe, and other countries. And one thing that actually encouraged me to write this book is to ask a question. If Mohammed bin Salman is such a great reformer, why are those Saudis leaving the country and becoming exiles and asylum seekers abroad? Women, if he's promoting and empowering women, why have we got runaway girls? And this is a new phenomenon. Runaway girls, young girls who leave the country without the permission of their guardians, they escape, and once they arrive in international airports around the world, they seek asylum. So if driving is the dream of every Saudi woman, why do these young women leave the country when driving becomes legal? So it's a very, very mixed situation. And democracy is not beyond the horizon of many Saudis. They can participate in elections. They understand the principles of democracy.
Now, your family and you yourself, of course, have been outside Saudi Arabia quite a long time, much preceding Mohammed bin Salman. Tell us what your family's story was.
It's a long story, but to sum it up...
We've got about 5 minutes, so go on.
Right. I'm born into a family that had a history in the country as local rulers of part of what is now Saudi Arabia. And they had battles and they lost the war to the Al Saud. But also they are interconnected through a series of marriages with the Al Saud because they're part of this Arabian sort of nobility. And in my situation, I sort of became an exile as a teenager. I didn't choose to be an exile. It's because of the position of my father, my uncle, and the whole family history. So I left in Saudi Arabia in 75, then returned briefly. And then at the end, I came to Britain to study and decided to stay. And I chose a career that can never flourish in a dictatorship. You cannot write history or social science in a country like Saudi Arabia if you want to maintain your ability to have critical thinking. And it is impossible. All my books are banned in Saudi Arabia. In fact, Amnesty International reported that one of the charges against a group of civil society activists when they went to court in Saudi Arabia, that they had my books and articles stored on their computer. So if a history book or definitely the Sun King will not be allowed in Saudi Arabia, it will be censored. But if you can't write with freedom, if you can't defend human rights, if you can't engage in conversation with feminists, Islamists, nationalists, if you can't do all these things, you can't really become an academic in Saudi Arabia unless you become a loyalist academic. And I chose not to go down that path because I couldn't be a loyalist in a regime that deprives me of my basic freedom of speech.
Now, this excellent book is full of really very forensic criticisms of the Sun King, the title itself, of Mohammed bin Salman. Do you ever feel in danger yourself? You've been every bit as critical as Khashoggi was.
Yes, I mean, I've been in danger a long time ago when I published my PhD thesis in 1991. I received threats that if I was going to publish it, I will be subjected to disciplinary action. And that came from the Saudi government before MBS. But after Khashoggi was murdered, all Saudi exiles, and there is a growing community in London and in Washington and everywhere, we became very, very troubled by how far the regime could go to eliminate critical voices. But if I'm going to live in fear, I should go back to Saudi Arabia. I cannot live abroad in fear because of my writing or what my writing would cause me. Once you make that decision, then you dismiss this moment of fear. I do believe that I'm only writing words. And obviously, words are not appreciated in dictatorships. So I will continue my academic career, my writing, and I deliberately take the side of the people who are in Saudi prisons, of the women who are detained simply for asking for certain rights that the whole world enjoys. And once you make that decision, I think you become a target.
And you won't be accepting any invitations to conferences in Saudi Arabia with a private jet to take you there?
Well, absolutely not. I wouldn't even go to the Saudi embassy in London or the consulate. I do remember as a student in Britain, my Saudi passport expired, and I would not go to the embassy or the consulate to renew my passport because I knew and I had the awareness that governments can do nasty things in their consulates or embassies because they're sovereign territories belonging to them.
Well, quite right. Yeah, well, there's proof, isn't there? So we are almost running out of time, but time for a couple of quick questions. Oil, as we try to use less oil in the rest of the world, what effect is that going to have on Saudi Arabia, whose economy is, of course, already getting squeezed?
Yes, absolutely. There is a shift, and it is in world consumption, even without COVID. And for a country that is totally dependent on oil, Mohammed bin Salman is trying to diversify, but it doesn't happen overnight. They had been used to oil revenues, And part of his plan in Vision 2030 is to increase the diversification of the economy. And we shall see. He has been forced to draw on the National Sovereign Fund to cover government expenditure and also borrowing. So that is going to actually change the dynamics, the political dynamics between the ruling family and society, a society that has been used to a welfare state that is well-developed, housing, education, scholarships abroad, and all that is going to stop.
We've got a few more questions I just wanted to get onto. There was one that was asked some time ago, actually. You know, there's been some talk that the custody of the holy mosques in Jerusalem might be transferred to Saudi Arabia. At the moment, formally, it's, of course, in the hands of Jordan. Do you see anything in that?
I doubt it, actually. It will be very, very difficult to do that.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the jihadist extremists, Al-Qaeda, some extent ISIS. The question is, the Saudi elite funded and supported Al-Qaeda and to some extent ISIS. What would it take for us to see that dynamic re-emerging?
As I said earlier, you know, the Wahhabi tradition is still there and it is used at the moment selectively in the war on Yemen and in sort of suppressing any kind of political activism in the country. And as long as it's there, you know, it can be reactivated. If we look just briefly at the history, the Wahhabi movement emerged in the 18th century and then the Ottoman Empire destroyed it at the beginning of the 19th century. But it was still there and it was revived by the Al Saud at the beginning of the 20th century with the help of the British government at the time. So it goes in cycles, and I wouldn't be surprised if it splinters into something else and erupts in different ways. But you have to think of it as a totalitarian system. And any totalitarian system is subject to being fractured, and you have splinter group emerging because they argue about the interpretation of their doctrines and texts all the time. And the jihadi tradition or the Al-Qaeda, they used aspect of the Wahhabi tradition, interpreted it in a different way. So they and the loyal Wahhabis only differ slightly about interpretation of their doctrine because they have the same source. And this, we know, like totalitarian system always break up and always have radical fringe movements. I wouldn't be surprised if it erupts again in some time in the future.
Tell us how significant Saudi support was for Al-Qaeda during its more prominent days. And of course, various affiliates very much still exist. And when I put these questions myself to, you know, important or unimportant people in Saudi Arabia, they say, well, look, we worked very hard to stop these people. We eliminated them. It's absolutely wrong to say that the Saudis expedited those particular movements in different parts, not just of the Middle East, but elsewhere. Where does the truth lie on that one?
Well, there are historical records that many historians, academics, including myself, had consulted. The whole idea of this global jihad, you go to Afghanistan first. They thought that they could, it is the child of many governments and not only the Saudi government. So Saudi Arabia provided the doctrine and the money. The United States, Britain, and other countries pushed for that project, and Pakistan facilitated it on the ground. So in order to defeat the Soviet Union, they thought radical Islam, or Islam at the time, could be an antidote to communism, and it can mobilize Muslims around the globe to go to Afghanistan and liberate it. And that was the Saudi government's active participation. I don't know how many people know that King Salman himself was running a fund to help the jihadis to go to Afghanistan. And also they were given a reduction on Saudi airline to fly to Peshawar and to other cities in Pakistan and regroup with Osama bin Laden. So that phase is forgotten as Saudi Arabia switched from a supporter of that Afghan jihad to being a victim of that jihad. So it was easier for them to fall out with the Saudi leadership and turn against the Saudi leadership. And the Saudi leadership also started feeling the pressure between 2003 and 2008. Saudi Arabia witnessed the worst terrorism episode in its modern history because those Afghan Arabs, as they were called, returned to Saudi Arabia and started a terrorism campaign. So they actually tasted what they have been exporting. And it was a misguided policy on behalf of several governments to weaponize Islam in the fight against the Soviet Union. That weaponization, we are still living under the dark side of that misguided foreign policy.
But now we've finally run out of time. I'd like to thank you very much for taking part in what for me has been, and I'm sure for everybody else, an absolutely fascinating hour. I'd like to thank, of course, not just you, but the audience, Intelligence Squared. I'd also like to remind everybody watching here that you can get, well, not just one copy, you can order multiple copies of the book with the Intelligence Squared discount, and that is via the link in the chat tab at the right-hand side of your screen. And, you know, it's been really, really interesting. And by the way, guys, there are lots of books around at the moment about this particular man, but get this one. Start here. The others are good too, but this is the one that matters. This is where you begin. So thank you so much once again for talking to us this evening.
Thank you.